I don't think so. She went to a doctor appointment. She had an eye appointment.
Hi, Jeff. This is Cheryl.
Cheryl, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
How's your monsters?
They're just absolutely adorable. Oh, my. Am I lucky or what?
That's very fortunate. Yeah.
Hello, this is Rob.
Rob.
Hi, Rob. This is Cheryl.
Hi, Cheryl. Thanks for joining us.
Well, I'm sorry I didn't make it yesterday. I've been trying to get over this sinus infection, and
sure,
it wouldn't have been pretty.
Sure. Well, we're recording this because this is posted on our website, and people come onto the website and listen to it later on. So perhaps I'll just get started since it's 3:30 and give an overview, and we'll see if other people join us.
Perfect.
Is there anyone else on the line yet?
Nope.
Nope. Okay. So the most prevalent factor in today's market is certainly the Federal Reserve Bank. As most people are aware, the Federal Reserve has recently injected another $600 billion into the system whereby they are purchasing the debt that's issued by the U.S. Treasury.
Oh, and, wow.
This isn't exactly the same thing as printing money, but it's pretty close. The Federal Reserve Bank has really become the lender and the backstop for pretty much all large industrial and financial companies, going from General Motors to Bank of America. And the assumption that the Federal Reserve and the U.S. government will not let sort of the stocks of these companies go bankrupt, and that they will buttress their operations is pretty much a given, and really has served to allow General Motors, for example, to
Anna Ratoon.
Excellent.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us, Hannah.
Thank you.
So the main thing that's going on in today's economy is the Federal Reserve, our central bank, is essentially flooding and pushing money into the markets. Now, that's very helpful in the short term. It's helped the stock market go up the last 2 or 3 months. And it's also pushed the value of the U.S. dollar down. Now, why does anyone care what happens with the U.S. dollar unless you're traveling in Europe and it becomes more expensive to buy a cappuccino in Rome? Well, the U.S. dollar, by becoming cheaper, allows companies based in the U.S. to sell more things abroad because it's cheaper for foreigners to buy our goods. And when you read in the newspaper about the G20 nations meeting now, or about currency wars, the new prime minister in Brazil, a woman who talks about the U.S. and China, if you look at the front of the New York Times, the Chinese protesters are carrying signs sort of denigrating the U.S. for depreciating our currency. It's, in fact, what we are accusing in the press the Chinese of doing, of keeping their currency low, because keeping a currency low allows a domestic economy to create more employment opportunities. And that's why there's essentially, in the Great Depression, everybody devalued their currencies, and so no jobs were created. And now the political leaders of all the countries are saying that they're going to cooperate, and no one's going to take those currency devaluation measures that happened 80 years ago. But in fact, most countries are doing that, including our own. So we have We have the Federal Reserve flooding the market with their purchases. It's raised the stock market. It's lowered the U.S. dollar. It hasn't really created any employment opportunities yet. We don't really see the age groups really that are most hurt for employment are those sort of the 18 to 30 range, and then the sort of 55 to you know, the people who in better times might have retired who are looking for work. There really are very few jobs out there for people like that. It's estimated that about 17% of the U.S. population is either out of work or stopped looking for work or working part-time when they'd like to work full-time or working a job that's, you know, substantially beneath their education or capabilities. So in the Great Depression, that number was around 25%.
Wow.
And we all have images of the hobos riding the railroads. It's pretty hard to hitch a ride on the railroad today. They go a lot faster and are probably more dangerous today. So, but we do have very high unemployment. Real estate prices and the whole foreclosure situation in the U.S. where there are about 2 million homes on the market. The inventory is very high, and there are probably an equal number of people who are in danger of losing their home. I think pretty much everyone knows someone now who is in that situation, whereas 5 or 10 years ago it was an unusual situation for people to walk away from their homes. And in essence, the Federal Reserve is trying to get people to start spending. That's the goal, is to reignite some kind of real long-term growth by pushing interest rates low. It's quite possible that they will not be successful. It will have no impact on employment or consumer spending. And in which case, we're in it's a little bit like a chess game where there's a stalemate. There's really nothing more that anyone can do. And if the Federal Reserve and the government is unsuccessful in this latest attempt, the next time there's some economic calamity, which if we go back 10 years, we can start with the tech market bust when all the high-flying tech companies' stocks went way down. Then September 11th, when the market closed for 3 or 4 days and opened much, much lower. Then the, you know, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I almost said Iran there, so hopefully that's not what's coming. And then the real estate and financial meltdown in 2008. Each one of those political crises or economic crises was followed by essentially the same action, which is the Fed stepping in and saying, it's all okay, we're going to put money into the system so everyone can keep on with the same kind of spending party. And I don't really believe that they're going to be successful with this current efforts to reignite spending, because there are many, many people in the sort of the baby boomers, the people born between, let's say, 45, 46, and 64, who are thinking more seriously about retiring and saving money as opposed to spending money. That is, unless you have a daughter in a very worthwhile elite East Coast school. And then
right,
you're
right.
Definitely on the spending roll.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it's well worth it, right, Hannah?
Sure, to expand my mind in many ways.
Yes. So,
yes.
It's interesting that education and health and all of the entire, you know, the programs that really made the U.S. such a strong nation in the past, our infrastructure, our educational system, our openness to immigration for talent from overseas to be attracted here, all of those things are under duress now because of the budget difficulties, California being a good example, kind of a harbinger of what might come in the United States as a whole. You see California's university system cutting back on class offerings, increasing class size, increasing student fees. We'll talk a little bit in a minute about what's going on in other countries around the world. I don't know whether you all saw the news from England, where they're proposing tripling the student fees in England, and the students rioted and attacked some of the political parties' home offices and shattered windows and things like that. That happened earlier this week. So it's not just a U.S. phenomena where we're facing these sort of growing expenses of just taking care of an aging population, of aging infrastructure, lower receipts on the part of governments because people are not making as much, sort of higher promised benefits like Obamacare and just the unemployment benefits that have been extended until quite recently. And so you have these sort of glacial forces coming to rest where no one's quite sure what's going to happen. The short-term result has been a good environment for stocks because interest rates are so low, no one wants to leave their money in the banks in a CD or even buy short-term bonds or long-term bonds since they're paying so low. So it has had an effect of buoying up stock prices in this country. But that hasn't translated really into increased consumer confidence, nor has it translated into a bottom for the real estate market. My estimate is that it will probably be a decade, 10 years, before many real estate markets bottom out. It could happen quicker, but I don't think so. So we have these very large forces at play. We have a very much diminished capacity of the central banks, certainly in the U.S., to take effective action, and that sort of will bring us back to, well, what does one do in that kind of environment with investments? Let me talk just for a minute about what's going on in other countries. And then we'll come back and talk about the markets and open up for questions. So, as I mentioned, in England, England has taken a diametrically opposed approach to the U.S. in response to their financial crisis and their budget deficits. They have decided, rather than to promote spending by injecting money into their system, they are tightening their belts. And they're raising the retirement ages, just like in France. They recently did that, notwithstanding the student and labor protests in France. And England is cutting back on pretty much all government services. They're not raising taxes to any great degree, but they're undergoing a financial austerity plan. And we'll see if that's successful in bringing back capital and eventually increasing job opportunities in England. Ireland, next door to England, is about to face a crisis of the same proportions as Greece faced earlier in the year, where, in fact, the Greek government and country were in default. They were about to declare bankruptcy. And the European Union, that's not really true. Germany, as the only strong economic power in the European Union, other than the northern Baltic states like Norway and Sweden with their oil and technology, but Germany primarily came in and bailed Greece out. Ireland is facing the same kind of situation that Iceland faced last year, where a reliance on their banking system to generate jobs and growth and real estate, a real estate boom, has fallen flat on its face. The Irish, to their credit, are really trying to face up to their problems after about 8 reiterations of lying on the part of the bank officials as far as how bad their problems were. And essentially, the banks are bankrupt in Ireland, and the government needs to come in and will come in and bail them out. But the government of Ireland can't do it by themselves. They absolutely require European Union assistance, and there is a lot of cross guarantees on the part of the governments in Europe to come to each other's aid, and that's likely going to happen. What's different about Ireland now is they're talking about having people who lent Ireland money suffer some of the consequences of this de facto default, where bondholders will take a haircut. Well, they'll have to take 50 or 70 cents on the dollar, just like a corporation that is bankrupt. So there's likely to be a lot of bad news in the press about Ireland, about Europe. That tends to be good for the United States as people funnel money in this direction. As things are bad in Europe, certainly Japan is still caught in a 20-year period where there's no economic growth. Japan has already been through the process that we're undergoing, where they reduce their interest rates close to zero and are doing what they can to stimulate the economy by government fiat unsuccessfully. People in Japan just don't spend. They're worried about the future. Japan has the added disadvantage of having a rapidly aging and rather insular population because Japan doesn't really allow anyone to emigrate there. They want to keep their race pure and polite, I guess, at least on the surface. So the prospects for Japan are rather dim. People point to Japan and say this is likely to happen in the U.S., the same kind of stagnation. I don't think so. I think the U.S., we have a much more diverse and dynamic and open economy, even with all our problems. And so I don't think we're in for the same fate as Japan. But so you have trouble in the Eurozone, trouble in Japan. Where's the good news? I guess in Asia, there's quite strong growth. Latin America is booming in many ways. Based on their young population, very highly motivated, educated, internet savvy. I just saw a statistic that the U.S. is number 22 in the world in terms of internet connectivity, in terms of the percentage of the population that has access to the internet and the speed of that access, number 22. Not too stellar a rating. So Asia really is where the growth is happening. I'm not particularly enamored with China in particular. Their environmental challenges and the kind of the autocracy that has power in China is not one that I like to deal with. So we tend to look for trading opportunities with companies that provide supplies to China as the way to participate in that market. So in the developed world, things are looking rather tight and not very optimistic. The reverse is true about the developing world, and maybe that's the way it's supposed to be. I guess it is supposed to be that way, since it is. This kind of leveling out of affluence around the world, it's hard to imagine what will happen, you know, when the car ownership in China parallels that in the U.S. Unless they use electric cars, it doesn't look good for air quality or the supply of petroleum with that kind of demand. But that's kind of the roundup. Just a brief overview of the markets and what kind of opportunities or challenges those circumstances present. And then if anyone has questions, it'd be great to hear them. the with interest rates being low, very difficult, we think, not productive to be investing in long-term bonds or even medium-term bonds at this point. You have companies like IBM and Microsoft coming out and selling 2% bonds for 20 or 30 years. That sounds like a pretty bad deal to me, and we think the people that buy those kinds of bonds will be hurt drastically. The stock market, with this kind of artificial support from the government, the only parts of the stock market that we like are international companies that pay a good dividend, that have a financial, sound financial basis to pay a reasonable dividend. So we are one word about gold, which has gone up a great deal. People look to gold and say, oh, well, inflation's got to be coming. These governments have got to default, and the only thing that's worthwhile is gold. You know, that may be true. It's hard to believe that gold will actually, you know, play the part of any kind of international trade because there's so little gold out there. I heard that if you took all the gold that was ever mined and you could load it on 40 semis, and that would be it.
Wow.
Or if you laid all the gold that's ever been taken out of the ground on a football field, it would only be 6 inches high.
Mm.
So it's hard to imagine the world's economy revolving around gold. That's how, you know, some people's emotional reaction to the complexity and the size of the deficits and the trade imbalances that are taking place. But so we're a believer to own some gold, but not a great deal. Agricultural land is doing well. Anything that's productive, natural resources, is something that we've held on to. Natural gas has been very low, continues to be low, but we think affords some good long-term possibilities. And the other investment opportunity that relates to the financial condition of the states and other municipalities in the U.S. who are facing budget deficits, but who have to balance their budgets, we're pretty big believers that the states of New York and California are decent investments because they have assets that they can sell to cover their debts and other measures that they can take. So I guess that sort of summarizes where I believe things are, and let's open it up to questions.
How about we've had some challenges and problem areas like earlier you alluded to. We had the tech bubble, and then we went into real estate. There were some challenges there. What do you anticipate could be some problem areas of the markets going forward?
Well, the bond area is one, or mutual funds that invest in medium long-term bonds, that invest in high-yield bonds, funds that have bonds in Europe. These are typically seen as very safe investments, and people who need income have piled hundreds of billions of dollars into them during 2010. They're likely going to tank if there's some kind of a crack in the system, or if inflation comes back and people expect interest rates to rise. Certainly the stated policy of the U.S. government is to keep interest rates down. The rest of the world doesn't feel that way. Certainly Australia and Canada, the natural resource economies, even England is looking at, and Germany and China are looking at raising their interest rates. And that may force the U.S. to raise rates, and in which case those traditional safe havens become very dangerous places to be. Cheryl or Hannah, any questions?
Yeah, off of the tech bubble, I don't know if you've heard of a scientist named Ray Kurzweil.
Yes.
But he came and did a lecture at my school, and I was just wondering if you had any advice about sort of a more specific question, investing in medical technology, and whether or not you see a future in that, and
yes,
how to go about really trusting what company to invest in.
Yeah.
And how to approach that.
Yeah, there are a couple of good questions there. One is the sort of entrepreneurial and innovative nature of U.S. Of people in the U.S. really continues. I think there are definitely investment opportunities in small companies that are developing new technologies. It's very hard when you're not in that field to know what's valid and what might work, but there certainly are job opportunities and investment opportunities in new technologies, particularly medical technologies. There's a great research being done around the country, both private and publicly funded, in the biotech area, and it's really an exciting field. It doesn't really create a lot of jobs or big company opportunities because there are very technically proficient people in India and that do a lot of the research for U.S.-based companies now. There are great universities over there and a lot of math and science students coming out of those schools. So how do you know who to trust? The question of sort of corporate responsibility and truthfulness is a very large question. I'm very skeptical. Any bad news is never disclosed until the absolute last moment after the companies have taken actions to present themselves. So individual investors are always at risk for things going on in companies that they will not have a clue about until essentially it's too late. So there's really no way around that. When you're looking for companies, you can look for honesty and integrity, but really it's impossible to know in areas like biotech or medical technology for the aging population. The only thing I can think of is to diversify when you're buying companies like that, and there are stock vehicles that buy a lot, you know, many different companies that are in these startup phases, and the hope is, and usually what does happen is the larger companies tend to buy them out when they have a proven technology. So if you can get in on the ground floor through something that you know about personally or someone you know is really up on that technology, that's one way to do it. Another way is to look at very forward-thinking companies that are interested in acquiring these small companies in the biotech area.
Thank you.
Rob, you were talking about the Feds are keeping our interest rates low. You know, I guess I've been watching too much TV lately, but they're talking about reducing the deficit and what they have to do, and which is going
right.
to take away our advantage on being able to write off, you know, any kind of interest we have on our mortgage. And I
right.
think capping it at $500,000 or something. I mean, nobody knows, I guess, right now what they're going to do. But we're paying for this anyway. So, but isn't that going to discourage people from going into buying houses? If wouldn't it just be to their advantage to put their money somewhere else? And
yeah, you know, it's a little bit like the Obama tax cuts that he wants. He's really trying to protect the working and the middle class, and figuring that anyone who has a mortgage over $500,000 really doesn't need the mortgage deduction because they can afford a house that's worth $700,000 or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, from a fairness, sort of a traditional progressive taxation perspective, it makes sense to eliminate that, just like it makes sense to eliminate Social Security for people who have X amount of income outside of the these kind of safety, the social safety nets. You know, it's whether it will come to pass that way or not is a guess, and it's a ways off, that's for sure. But clearly, there, some of the other things that this White House economic committee just recommended, like raising the age at which Social Security is made available, those things clearly have to happen. There are too many baby boomers who would be owed too much money to pay them all that was promised. It just can't be done unless the young people are going to be enslaved forever to pay their parents' Social Security, which I guess is a possibility, but not necessarily. It doesn't really entice people to go to work when their Social Security tax rates are going up and their benefits are going down, clearly. So that same kind of cut in benefits will have to be implemented on a state and local level. In the past 20 or 30 years, the public employees unions have become the largest and most powerful unions, and the benefits and wages that people that work for governments have gone up, way up in relation to what private workers are getting, and that certainly has got to change. So we're likely to see a lot of these social contracts rewritten, reneged upon, whatever you want to call it, to avoid these crashes. And this latest or first round of suggestions by this policy committee really are just laying the groundwork for people to understand that this is part of the debate. Everything's on the table, mortgage interest deductions, but I think they're couching it in a way that if people actually thought about their self-interest and knew what people knew what the politicians were talking about, it would make sense. But that's a whole different subject.
Really? Thank you. On this, the real estate market, I know that for the past couple of years it's been, you know, now the market's going to be flooded, from what I understand, with more foreclosures.
Yes.
I guess after they figure out the whole paperwork fiasco. But so you see real estate in the same light that you have in the past, let's say 6 months to a year, that it's going to be a while before it comes back?
Definitely. The worst may have passed in terms of shock, but there are many people who are still holding on to their homes and not selling them because they're not willing to lower the prices. And there are many people who are just now being faced with the understanding that their homes are not worth as much as they owe on them. And if they want to move, which Americans tend to do with pretty regular frequencies, you know, they can just get up and walk away, and personally, other than their credit ratings, they're better off doing that. So it doesn't mean that there aren't pockets of very valuable real estate that will go up, like San Francisco or, you know, parts of New York City or Washington, D.C., or that aren't going to continue to go up because they're just highly desirable. But in general, the feelings of confidence that people get when their houses are going up 5% a year, they're more willing to borrow money, they're more willing to spend on big ticket items than when they're unsure whether their houses are going down. The value is going down, and that when they want to retire and downsize, that they'll be able to sell their houses for anything that makes sense, that's going to allow them to continue on. So I don't think I don't even think we've seen the worst yet in terms of the financial soundness of the banks and the government agencies that handle mortgages. They're in terrible condition. I don't necessarily think they're in as bad condition as Ireland's banks are, but they're in very, very bad condition. They're bankrupt. They're on life support from the government now. The the Federal Home Loan and the other U.S. institutions that basically are responsible for financing most of the homes in the country are bankrupt. They're on a couple of $100 billion more every year is what they need. They're just so poorly managed and people. When I say people, I mean the financial industry took such advantage and people participated, the public really believed that they could just keep buying real estate and it was just going to go up. And it's interesting because that's the sense I get that's going on in the coastal cities in China now. You have lots of people borrowing money to buy second and third places just to turn around and sell. They're building like crazy. It's what we saw for 5 years here during the last decade. And people will just stay put, I think, and there'll be new kinds of sort of family situations where people who can't afford to go out on their own because it's too expensive or hard to get credit, you know, we'll figure out how to put up with their families and how to live like most people throughout history have lived. So I think America becomes a less mobile and less home-owning society. That provides some opportunities for people that own good rentals because the pool of rental population and the quality is going up.
Right. Thank you.
Good. Any other questions or
Rob?
Yeah.
This is George. Hi, I wanted to ask you, if I had to kind of summarize my own kind of take on what you said, it's that a lot of areas that traditionally were considered like conservative or dynamic investments are deeply sick now, and that there's a lot of uncertainty in the system. And so the best policy would be to maximal diversification with an emphasis on those areas that where long-term prognosis would suggest would have to do well, like, for instance, Brazil, Russia, India, China, you know, the emerging countries will be doing better than the developed ones, and sustainable technologies and energy will probably do better than ones that are being kind of, depleting, like, or that are causing so much pollution and greenhouse and other effects that we have to cut back on them. In other words, you do long-term analysis and you try to diversify with an emphasis on those areas that will probably do well.
Is that a question, or do you want me to...
It's a question. Is this kind of like going in the direction that if you had to?
Yeah, you know, I think all kinds of energy present opportunities because even oil, however dirty it is or difficult it is still a very valuable and necessary commodity out there in greater and greater demand. And so I think energy is one of the areas that has some stability to it. I am very hesitant about recommending direct investment in Brazil and India and China, even if their populations are growing and they're gaining economic clout. I don't believe that U.S. investors are given a fair shake. Even domestic investors are really because those governments are so tenuous about their commitment to real markets. They look good now, and they may be good for years, but at some point when there's a problem, I think they'll just wipe out foreign investors. And so I am not a proponent of investing directly in those countries. I may miss out on profit opportunities, and you know what? That's okay, because I'd rather own companies in Australia that trade with China than try and invest directly in China. So, but I think your overall thesis of diversification is right on, and that traditional areas, traditional stocks and bonds have limited upside, limited income going forward, and so it's very important to look outside the box. And unfortunately, that takes more work, and it's not as easy to do it from your home computer and check in every day and feel good. It's more hands-on. It's more, I don't want to say local, but you have to have a greater familiarity with the markets that you're involved with. And, you know, Brazil and India may be better, but than China. But again, there's an overlap between politics and economics and the market, and that's really what we're talking about, is that the political situation requires that the general public be built and be led to not revolting or not overthrowing the social system, because that's not what anyone in power wants. And I think the Chinese government and the U.S. government and the oil exporting nations all have a vested interest in keeping the system going. So I don't see a meltdown, but again, I don't see the kinds of investment returns that people had in the 80s and the 90s, or even in parts of the last decade in real estate. Those kinds of investment opportunities are few and far between, as Hannah was asking about. The biotech industry, there probably are some real profit opportunities, or in nanotechnology or communication technology, and we are doing some shorting. We're betting that some markets are overvalued, like the treasury market or the high yield market, and even the Chinese property market. So we're for growth oriented investors, we are doing some unusual things that are not necessarily long term, but And for income investors, we're looking for rental properties that have a good cash flow, or these companies that pay good dividends, like Johnson & Johnson or some of the large drug companies. We're not buying them for their growth. We're buying them for their dividends, for their large international diversification, their ability to buy up these small biotech companies, and essentially, they could be lying to us about what's going on in the companies, but there's no way to do anything about that. So I think you're right. You've got the big picture right, I think, in terms of broad diversification.
Thank you.
Good. Well, thank you everyone for joining us, and
thank you, Rob.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks.
Great. You're very welcome. Good. Take good care, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.